Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Netta Ulaby. The National Book Awards are the literary world's answer to the Oscars, although the annual award ceremony in New York is somewhat less glamorous. Ever since 1950, when the first awards were given, judges have picked such stars as novelist Ralph Ellison and poet Marianne Moore. This week, you can hear readings from the winners of the 2007 National Book Awards. For fiction, the heavily favored Tree of Smoke, a Vietnam epic by Dennis Johnson. For nonfiction, a bit of a surprise, Tim Weiner's Legacy of Ashes. The Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter leads us into the CIA's history of failures. In the young adult category, Sherman Alexie won for his tragicomic novel, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. And for poetry, we have U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Haas and his collection, Time and Materials. All readings are by the authors except Dennis Johnson's Tree of Smoke. It's read by actor Neil Huff. The novel, according to the Washington Post, wraps around you as tightly as a jungle snake.
This is from Tree of Smoke. I will do my best to let Dennis be my ghost reader. 1963. Last night at 3 a.m., President Kennedy had been killed. Seaman Houston and the other two recruits slept while the first reports traveled around the world. There was one small night spot on the island, a dilapidated club with big revolving fans in the ceiling and one bar and one pinball game. The two Marines who ran the club had come by to wake them up and tell them what had happened to the president. The two Marines sat there with the three sailors on the bunks in the Quonset hut for transient enlisted men, watching the air conditioner drip water into a coffee can and drinking beer. The Armed Forces Network from Subic Bay stayed on through the night, broadcasting bulletins about the unfathomable murder. Now it was late in the morning, and Seaman Apprentice William Houston Jr. began feeling sober again as he stalked the jungle of Grande Island carrying a borrowed .22-caliber rifle. There were supposed to be some wild boars roaming this island military resort, which was all he had seen so far of the Philippines. He didn't know how he felt about this country. He just wanted to do some hunting in the jungle. There were supposed to be some wild boars around here. He stepped carefully, thinking about snakes, and trying to be quiet because he wanted to hear any boars before they charged him. He was aware that he was terrifically on edge. From all around came the 10,000 sounds of the jungle, as well as the cries of gulls and the far-off surf. And if he stopped dead and listened a minute, he could hear also the pulse snickering in the heat of his flesh and the creak of sweat in his ears. If he stayed motionless only another couple of seconds, the bugs found him and whined around his head. He propped the rifle against the stunted banana plant, removed his headband and wrung it out, and wiped his face and stood there a while, waving away the mosquitoes with the cloth and itching his crotch absentmindedly. Nearby, a seagull seemed to be carrying on an argument with itself, a series of protesting squeaks interrupted by contradictory lower-pitched cries that sounded like, "Ha! Ha! Ha!" And something moving from one tree to another caught Seaman Houston's eye. He kept his vision on the spot where he'd seen it among the branches of a rubber tree, putting his hand out for the rifle without altering the direction of his gaze. It moved again. Now he saw that it was some sort of monkey, not much bigger than a Chihuahua dog. Not precisely a wild boar, but it presented itself as something to be looked at, clinging by its left hand and both feet to the tree's trunk and digging at the thin rind with an air of tiny, exasperated haste. Seaman Houston took the monkey's meager back under the rifle's sight. He raised the barrel a few degrees and took the monkey's head into the sight. Without really thinking about anything at all, he squeezed the trigger. The monkey flattened itself out against the tree, spreading its arms and legs enthusiastically, and then, reaching around with both hands as if trying to scratch its back, it tumbled down to the ground. Seaman Houston was terrified to witness its convulsions there. It hoisted itself, pushing off the ground with one arm, and sat back against the tree trunk with its legs spread out before it like somebody resting from a difficult job of labor. Seaman Houston took himself a few steps nearer, and from the distance of only a few yards, he saw that the monkey's fur was very shiny and held a henna tint in the shadows and a blonde tint in the light as the leaves moved above it. It looked from side to side, its breath coming in great rapid gulps, its belly expanding tremendously with every breath like a balloon. The shot had been low, exiting from the abdomen. Seaman Houston felt his own stomach tear itself in two. "Jesus Christ!" he shouted at the monkey, as if it might do something about its embarrassing and hateful condition. He thought his head would explode if the forenoon kept burning into the jungle all around him, and the gulls kept screaming, and the monkey kept regarding its surroundings carefully, moving its head and black eyes from side to side, like someone following the progress of some kind of conversation, some kind of debate, some kind of struggle that the jungle, the morning, the moment, was having with itself. Seaman Houston walked over to the monkey and laid the rifle down beside it and lifted the animal up in his two hands, holding its buttocks in one and cradling its head with the other. With fascination, then with revulsion, he realized that the monkey was crying. Its breath came out in sobs, and tears welled out of its eyes when it blinked. It looked here and there, appearing no more interested in him than in anything else it might be seeing. "Hey," Houston said, but the monkey didn't seem to hear. As he held the animal in his hands, its heart stopped beating. He gave it a shake, but he knew it was useless. He felt as if everything was all his fault, and with no one around to know about it, he let himself cry like a child. He was 18 years old. Thank you.
The best-selling Legacy of Ashes is Tim Weiner's critical examination of U.S. intelligence. Weiner reads from this year's National Book Awards nonfiction winner.
Good evening. This excerpt from Legacy of Ashes takes place in late 1964, early 1965. The place is Vietnam. The voices are those of Pierre de Silva, Chief of Station Saigon, Richard Helms, then the Chief of the Clandestine Service, the future Director of Central Intelligence, and the President of the United States. And the words are taken from declassified CIA documents, oral histories, interview, and the first-person memoirs of all three. "Vietnam was my nightmare for a good 10 years, said Richard Helms. The war was always with him. Like an incubus, he said. It involved efforts which were never to seem successful and demands which could never be met, but which were repeated, doubled, intensified, and redoubled. We tried every operational approach in the book, and we committed our most experienced field operatives to the effort to get inside the government in Hanoi," Helms said. "Within the agency, our failure to penetrate the North Vietnamese government was the single most frustrating aspect of those years. We could not determine what was going on at the highest levels of Ho's government, nor could we learn how policy was made or who was making it. At the root of this failure of intelligence was our national ignorance of Vietnamese history, society, and language," Helms said. "The great sadness was our ignorance, or innocence, if you like, which led us to misassess, not comprehend, and make a lot of wrong decisions. We didn't choose to know, and so we did not know how much we did not know. Lyndon Johnson also had a dream about Vietnam. If he ever wavered on the war, if he faltered, if he lost, there would be Robert Kennedy out in front leading the fight against me, telling everyone that I had betrayed John Kennedy's commitment to South Vietnam, that I was a coward, an unmanly man, a man without a spine. Oh, I could see it coming, all right. Every night when I fell asleep, I would see myself tied to the ground in the middle of a long open space. In the distance, I could hear the voices of thousands of people. They were all shouting and running toward me, "Coward! Traitor! Weakling!" The strength of the Viet Cong, the communist guerrillas in the South, continued to grow. Pierre de Silva, the CIA's station chief in Saigon, had been trying to extend the CIA's power by creating paramilitary patrols in the provinces to hunt down the Viet Cong. Working with the Interior Minister and the Chief of the National Police, de Silva bought an estate in the northeast corner of South Vietnam from a crooked labor union kingpin. And he began offering a crash course in counterinsurgency for civilians. In the first week of November 1964, as Americans were electing President Johnson to a full term, de Silva had flown up to inspect his fledgling project. His officers had trained three teams of 40 Vietnamese recruits who had reported killing 167 Viet Cong while losing only six of their own. Now de Silva wanted to fly 5,000 South Vietnamese citizens up to the estate from all over the country for a three-month education in political and military tactics taught by CIA officers and American military advisors. They would return home, in de Silva's words, as counter-terror teams, and they would kill the Viet Cong. Years later, de Silva mourned the agency's blindness to the enemy and to its strategy. In the villages, the Viet Cong use of terror was purposeful, precise, and frightful to behold, he wrote. The peasants would feed them, recruit for them, conceal them, and provide them with all the intelligence the Viet Cong needed. Then, at the end of 1964, the VC took the war to the capital. The Viet Cong use of terror within the city of Saigon was frequent, sometimes random, and sometimes carefully planned and executed, de Silva wrote. Secretary of Defense McNamara just missed being hit by a roadside bomb planted on the highway to the city from the airport. A car bomb destroyed the bachelor officers' quarters in Saigon on Christmas Eve, 1964. Slowly, the losses mounted as suicide bombers and sappers struck at will. We had more weapons and bigger ones, but they had more spies and better ones. It was a decisive difference. On March 30th, 1965, Pierre de Silva was in his second floor office at the CIA station in Saigon, catacorner to the embassy, talking on the telephone with one of his officers and staring out the window at a man pushing an old gray Peugeot sedan up the street. De Silva looked down at the driver's seat and he saw a detonator burning. "My world turned to glue in slow motion as my mind told me this car was a bomb," de Silva remembered. "With the phone still in my hand and without conscious thought, I began falling away from the window and turned as I fell, but I was only halfway to the floor when the car exploded." Flying glass and shards of metal slashed de Silva's eyes and ears and throat. The blast killed at least 20 people in the street and de Silva's 22-year-old secretary. Two CIA officers inside the station were permanently blinded. 60 other CIA and embassy personnel were injured. De Silva lost the vision in his left eye. Doctors pumped him full of painkillers, swaddled his head in gauze, and told him he might go completely blind if he stayed on in Saigon. The President of the United States wondered how to fight an enemy he could not see.
Poet, novelist, and screenplay writer Sherman Alexie won for his young adult literature debut. The New York Times says it took him only one book to master the form. Here Alexie reads from The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian.
F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote that the sign of a superior mind is the ability to hold two opposing ideas at the same time and not go crazy. And I disagree with Christopher Hitchens on the war in Iraq and religion, well, no, on God. But I agree with him on the dangers of fundamentalists and organized religion. And I'm able to deal with that without hissing, especially at this kind of occasion. And I agree with him on the sound of hissing. To me, it always sounded like the dreams and ambitions of white liberals escaping. I heard a lot of similar noises growing up, and that's why I wrote this book. There's all sorts of hissing. It's a multicultural event. So I'm going to read from my book, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. It was July. Crazy hot and dry. It hadn't rained in like 60 days. Drought hot, scorpion hot, vultures flying in the sky hot. Mostly rowdy, my best friend and I sat in my basement room, which was maybe 5 degrees cooler than the rest of the house, and read books and watched TV and played video games. Mostly rowdy and I just sat still and dreamed about air conditioning. When I get rich and famous, Rowdy said, I'm going to have a house that has an air conditioner in every room. But wait, I said, Sears has those big air conditioners that can cool a whole house. Just one machine? Yeah, you put it outside and you connect it through the air vents and stuff. Wow, how much does that cost? Like $1,000, I think. I'll never have that much money. You will when you play in the NBA, yeah, but I'll probably have to play pro ball in like Sweden or Norway or Russia or something. And I won't need air conditioning. I'll probably live in like an igloo and own reindeer or something. You're going to play for Seattle, Rowdy? Yeah, right. Rowdy didn't believe in himself, not much, so I tried to pump him up. You're the toughest kid on the res, I said. I know. You're the fastest and the strongest, I know, and the most handsome, too. Rowdy, if I had a dog with a face like yours, I'd shave its ass and teach it to walk backwards. Well, I once had a zit that looked like you, Junior, then I popped it, and it looked even more like you. This one time, Rowdy, I ate like 3 hot dogs and a bowl of clam chowder, and then I got diarrhea all over the place, and it looked like you. And then you ate it. We laughed ourselves silly. We were always laughing ourselves silly. We laughed ourselves sweaty. Don't make me laugh, I said. It's too hot to laugh. It's too hot to sit in this house. Let's get out of here. Let's get out of here now. And so we did. We walked over down to the West End to the tallest tree on the res. It was like 150 feet tall. Man, you could have built one house out of the wood from that tree. As we walked, I saw that monster pine tree ahead of us. It was so tall and green and beautiful. It was the only reservation skyscraper, you know. I love that tree, I said. That's because you're a tree fag, Rowdy said. I'm not a tree fag. Then how come you like to stick your dick inside knot holes? I stick my dick in the girl trees, I said. Rowdy laughed his ha-ha-hee-hee avalanche laugh. I loved to make him laugh. I was the only one who knew how to make him laugh. Hey, you know what we should do? I hated when Rowdy asked that particular question. It meant we were about to do something dangerous. We should climb that monster. And so we did. I mean, it wasn't open to debate. I had to climb the tree. Rowdy knew I had to climb the tree because I was with him. I couldn't back down. That was how our friendship worked. I spit on my hands, rubbed them together, and reached up for the first branch. I pulled myself up to the next branch, and then the next, and the next, and the next. Rowdy followed me. Branch by branch, Rowdy and I climbed toward the top of the tree, to the bottom of the sky. Near the top, the branches got thinner and thinner. I wondered if they'd support our weight. I kept expecting one of them to snap and send me plummeting to my death. But it didn't happen. The branches would not break. Rowdy and I climbed and climbed and climbed. We made it to the top. Well, almost to the top. Even Rowdy was too scared to step on the thinnest branches. So we made it within 10 feet of the top. Not the summit, but close enough to call it the summit. We were more than 100 feet in the air. From our vantage point, we could see for miles. We could see from one end of our reservation to the other. We could see our entire world. And our entire world, at that moment, was green and golden and perfect.
Time and Materials is the first new collection from Robert Haas in 10 years. According to one reviewer, it's his best in 30 years. Here the UC Berkeley poetry professor reads from his book of poems.
Thank you for that. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be among so many writers I admire. It seems on a night when writers are gathered together that somebody should remark on the fact that this war goes on and that we're in a condition such that the principal form of political discourse in the last month have been a gingerly discussion of how much Americans should torture their political enemies. But this is a fairly good-natured poem called I Am Your Waiter Tonight and My Name is Dimitri. I am your waiter tonight and my name is Dimitri is more or less the title of a poem by John Ashbery and has no investment in the fact that you can get an adolescent of the human species to do almost anything. And when adolescence in the human species ends is what the fat man in the Maltese Falcon calls a very nice question, sir, a very nice question indeed. Which is why they are tromping down a road in Fallujah in combat gear and 115 degrees of heat this morning, and why a young woman is strapping 20 pounds of explosives to her mortal body in Jerusalem. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. Have I mentioned that the other law of human nature is that human beings will do anything they see someone else do, and that someone will do almost anything? There is probably a waiter in this country so clueless he wears a t-shirt in the gym that says Dimitri. Not our protagonist. American amnesia is such that he may very well be the great-grandson of the elder Karamazov brother who fled to the Middle West with his girlfriend Grushenka. He never killed his father. It isn't true that he killed his father, but his religion was that woman's honey-colored head, an ideal tangible enough to die for, and he lived for it in Buffalo, New York, or Sandusky, Ohio. He never learned much English, but he slept beside her in the night until she was an old woman who still knew her way to the Russian pharmacist in a Chicago suburb where she could buy sachets of the herbs of the Russian summer that her coarse white nightgown smelled of as he fell asleep, though he smoked Turkish cigarettes and could hardly smell. Grushenka got two boys out of her body. One was born in 1894, the other in 1896. The elder having died in the mud at the Battle of the Somme from a piece of shrapnel manufactured by Alfred Nobel. Metal traveling at that speed works amazing transformation on the tissues of the human intestine. The other son worked construction the year his mother died. If they could have, they would have, if not filled, half-filled her coffin with the petals of buckwheat flowers from which Crimean bees made the honey bought in the honey market in St. Petersburg, not far from the place where Raskolnikov, himself an adolescent male, couldn't kill the old moneylender without killing her saintly sister, but killed her nevertheless, in a fit of guilt and reasoning which went something like this. Since the world evidently consists in the ravenous pursuit of wealth and power and in the exploitation and prostitution of women, except the holy self-sacrificing ones who make you crazy with guilt, and since I am going to be the world, I might as well take an axe to the head of this woman who symbolizes both usury and the guilt the virtue and suffering of women induces in men, and be done with it. I admit that the syntax of that sentence, like the intestines slithering from the hands of the startled boys clutching their belly wounds at the Somme, has escaped my grip. I step over it carefully. Where were we? Not far from the honey market, which is not far from the hay market. It is important to remember that the teeming cities of the 19th century were site central for horsewhipping. Humans had domesticated the race of horses some 10 centuries before, harnessed them, trained them, whipped them mercilessly for recalcitrants in Vienna, Prague, Naples, London, and Chicago, according to the novels of the period, which may have been noticing this for the first time, or registering an actual statistical increase in either human brutality or the insurrectionary impulse in horses, which were fed hay. So there was, of course, in every European city, a hay market, like the one in which Raskolnikov kissed the earth from a longing for salvation. Grushenka, though Dostoevsky made her, probably did not have much use for novels of ideas. Her younger son, a master carpenter, eventually took a degree in engineering from Bucknell University. He married an Irish girl from Vermont who was descended from the gardener of Emily Dickinson, but that's another story. Their son in Iwo Jima died, gangrene, but he left behind, curled in the body of the daughter of a Russian Jewish cigar maker from Minsk, the fetal curl of a being who became the lead dancer in the Cleveland Ballet, Radiant Tanya, who turned in a bad knee sometime in early 1971, just after her brother ate it in Cao Dai Diem for marriage and motherhood, which brings us to our waiter, Dmitri, who, you will have noticed, is not in Baghdad. He doesn't even want to be an actor. He has been offered roles in several major motion pictures and refused them because he is, in fact, under contract to John Ashbery, who is a sane and humane man and has no intention of releasing him from the poem. You can get killed out there. He is allowed to go home for his mother's birthday, and she has described to him on the phone, a cell phone. He's walking down Christopher Street with such easy bearing. He could be St. Christopher bearing innocence across a river, having come across a lock, the delicate curl of a honey-colored lock of his great-grandmother's Crimean honeybee pollen Russian spring wildflower sachet scented hair in the attic where it released for her in the July heat and the raftery midsummer dark, the memory of an odor like life itself carried to her on the wind. Here is your sea bass with a light lemon and caper sauce. Here is your dish of raspberries and chocolate. Notice their subtle transfiguration of the colors of excrement and blood. And here are the flecks of crystallized lavender that stipple it. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. These readings were recorded by Jeffrey Fryman Weyer on November 13, 2007, at the New School in New York City. For more readings like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.